And I was at the Normal Conference a few weeks ago. There was a speaker, William Billy Murphy, Esquire, and he would like me to say that he's a person classified as African-American, and he's a judge from Baltimore, Maryland. He did a lot of work on behalf of the Black Panthers and fought against what he would say is white supremacy here in this country. Yet he has a certain admiration for Lyndon Johnson. And what brought Lyndon Johnson around? And I thought it amazing to have this Black Panther lawyer, you know, giving Lyndon Johnson praise.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Before I wrote this book, I never would have thought that I would become an admirer of Lyndon Johnson or have affection for him. And I think, you know, anybody who lived through those years of the war in Vietnam and, you know, all the upheavals of the late 60s and the 1970s, you know, and leans at all toward the, you know, sort of left or progressive side of things probably feels some, you know, anger at LBJ over the war in Vietnam. But, you know, as you dig into the archives and you get closer to these stories, Johnson really emerges as a tragic figure. I mean, he was so committed to the struggle for civil rights, you know, after sort of watching the civil rights movement and listening to it and learning from it. And so actually the title of my book, Freedom is Not Enough, comes from Lyndon Johnson, from a really powerful speech he gave at Howard University in 1965. But the whole effort that he made, which I think, you know, in the future people will look back on as probably the most profound effort by any American president ever on behalf of the cause of civil rights, that whole effort was really derailed by the war in Vietnam. But the further tragedy there is that Johnson really understood everything that was wrong with the struggle in Vietnam, but he was deathly afraid of pulling out for fear that conservatives would go after him and destroy everything he was trying to do domestically, you know, as they had earlier with China and, you know, the loss of China. I don't want to get too into the particulars of that here, because I know that's not our subject, but that's of interest to my book, too, because one of the things I do in the book that's a little unusual is look at the history of the conservative movement, which was building in the same years as the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the Mexican-American movement. And Johnson was very right to be afraid of those forces. He actually described them as great beast and said that's what we should worry about because that was the great danger to fairness in American life. And so I agree with the person that you spoke to that I think, you know, as the years go on and we get these things in more perspective and historians begin to pay more attention to the conservative movement that Johnson had to be aware of because it was always over his shoulder, I think he will gain in stature.
And let's touch for a moment here on this idea of the feminist movement. And I was amazed here in you bringing this out because we don't hear this enough. Too many people think of this feminist movement as originating in perhaps in the 1960s. Yet that's not really true. And a feminist struggle began around the idea of women having equal rights in the workplace. And what were these victories? How did these women make this struggle happen? I know that there's the famous fire in New York in which the girls die in the textile factory. But what beyond that, what beyond these shocking events made that equality in the workplace happen?
Well, I'm glad that you picked up on that dimension of the story about the women's movement because, you know, we still have that anti-feminist myth out in the culture that the women's movement was a white middle-class effort and, you know, didn't care about working women or women of color. And part of the reason that that mythology hangs on, I think, is that people, historians and other scholars, haven't paid enough attention to these struggles over workplace issues and work and family issues. And if we focus attention on those efforts, what you see is a much more diverse group of women involved in the struggle for gender equity and from a much earlier time. So as you point out, you know, that struggle goes all the way back to the turn of the century and the great garment struggles of those years and, you know, the big strikes by women in the early part of the century. But women activists in the labor movement and in kind of related social justice efforts kept working all through the 20th century. So they didn't just, you know, go back to the kitchen after World War II. They were very active in pushing for, you know, equal pay for equal work, actually equal pay for comparable work. They were trying to find ways to get government and employers to recognize the burden of the double day on working women, protect women from pregnancy discrimination, get child care policies, et cetera. So those women who were working in that sort of wing of the women's movement were really the ones who grabbed hold of Title VII when the Civil Rights Act passed and said, wow, you know, here's our chance. We can really transform things for women in this country. And they really did. I mean, again, we forget the origins of these things today, but the kinds of struggles that I talk about in Freedom Is Not Enough are the reason that employers are no longer allowed to fire women for getting pregnant or for, you know, gaining weight, as the airlines used to do to women. They are the reason that we have policies for against sexual harassment, and so that women have some protection against that now. I mean, so much of what we take for granted is the result of these efforts, these very concerted and often very creative efforts on the part of, you know, tens of thousands of activists, in this case women.
And now let's, you know, we can't talk about all this without talking about affirmative action and the idea that today affirmative action, in my mind, and this is just my own opinion, has been moved into the political spectrum along with things like Medicare and Medicaid, things that are vastly changed, as you point out in the book, very indirectly as you examine the Reagan administration's, you know, actual successful, not just attempts, but successes at nullifying a lot of reforms. But how did we move out of this concept of affirmative action into this broader ideal of diversity, which has become more of a conservative buzzword these days?
Mm-hmm. Well, affirmative action was a kind of a logical outcome of, you know, as a kind of strategy to deal with the longstanding exclusion of women and of men of color from these better jobs. And so every single organization that was working to change things ended up turning to affirmative action like policies as an answer, you know, a way to broaden the recruitment of workers, to provide training, to get people into jobs they hadn't been able to do before, et cetera. And that was actually going, I mean, it was embattled, of course, but it was actually going pretty well, and some very significant changes happened over the course of the 1970s. Just to give you two examples, sex segregation in the workplace declined more in the 1970s than at any other time before or since in American history, and black workers made more economic progress in the South between 1965 and 1975 than, again, at any point in American history. But as I mentioned before, at the very time that these movements were building, conservatives were also developing a movement. You know, they had started work with the founding of the National Review magazine by William F. Buckley in 1955. And in the course of the 1970s, conservatives discovered that they could use this issue of affirmative action to reach a kind of blue collar constituency that had never before paid much attention to the right because they so disagreed with its economic program. But conservatives began to understand how to use the kinds of anxieties about economic security that were developing in the 1970s, along with the unease about changes in the racial and gender order, to build a mass following for their movement. And so they encouraged a whole series of reverse discrimination cases, as they were called, and really made quite a lot of headway in the courts and in public opinion with this. And then in 1977, in the Bakke case, a reverse discrimination case that went to the Supreme Court said that effectively, you know, racial justice could no longer be justification for affirmative action if you couldn't show actual discrimination against the individual concerned. But diversity, if it would be an institutional benefit, could be a justification. So at that point, the rationale for affirmative action switched to diversity. And I think many activists today don't even realize that this is the origin of the language that they're using, you know, that it came from the courts in 1977. But it's a shift that I think is a little bit alarming because it's made a lot of sense for business to argue it in this way and for public relations. But I think for some of the activist and advocacy groups, this language is problematic because it really drops out the questions of fairness, of justice, of power that were part of the earlier movement's ability to mobilize its own constituency.
Nancy, let me ask you one final question here today. You know, this book is about really a blue-collar grassroots movement, but this kind of change and this kind of change hasn't happened on, as I mentioned before, on the upper echelons of government and the very upper echelons of corporate America. Do you think that there's a possibility of some type of white-collar grassroots reform on this level up there?
Well, actually, the book starts as a kind of blue-collar story because that's where the real pressure came from, particularly from the civil rights movement, because black Americans are such a working-class people and were especially back then. But as the story develops, it really spills over to all kinds of occupations. And so there's a chapter, for example, on the struggle in higher education as women in particular pushed for access to faculty jobs, and what you see with the kind of cultural transformation that went on is that these pressures percolated out all over. So actually, you know, in some ways, I would say people in professional and managerial jobs have more demonstrable gains today than people in blue-collar jobs, not least because so many blue-collar jobs have been wiped out with economic restructuring. So the industries in which these campaigns made the most headway, like auto, steel, rubber, textiles, et cetera, a lot of those have lost jobs. But, you know, we do see significant change in many, you know, sort of middle-class and professional workplaces today. I know, for example, you know, where I work in higher education, the system is very dramatically different from what it was even in 1970. And so, you know, there's still discrimination, and when testers are used, you know, blind testers with equivalent resumes, they find that discrimination is, you know, is still out there and still significant. And as you say, there are these problems at the higher levels, but there has been significant change for, you know, sort of better off women and African Americans. And today, I think in some ways, the real challenge is in the low-wage jobs in the service sector that are, you know, peopled so heavily by men of color and women of all backgrounds.
Nancy McLean is professor of history and African American studies and chair of the history department at Northwestern University. Her new book is Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. Nancy, thanks for joining us here today on Active Voice Radio.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure.